The following message was given at Grace Community Church in Minden, Nevada.
All right. Well, today what we're going to do is we're going to spend all of our time in Ecclesiastes. And so if you go ahead and turn in your Bibles to the book of Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes actually has quite a bit to say about money. But it may not say the things about money that we sometimes think it should say about money. By the way, how many of you were here when I did Ecclesiastes? Okay, so a few of you. That was a long time ago. I forget, maybe 15 plus years ago. But I love Ecclesiastes. And I love Ecclesiastes and have devoted probably at least the last 17 years to continuing to study it and understand it better. And so this is, since we're going to talk about money in Ecclesiastes, this is my chance to win you to my view of Ecclesiastes, all right? So, by the way, the last time I taught Ecclesiastes was over in China, and it took me 2 days to convince the guys that my view of Ecclesiastes was correct, because things are deeply ingrained in us. So let me just start by making this as straightforward as possible. Ecclesiastes is not about the meaninglessness of life under the sun. Okay? Ecclesiastes is emphatically not. There's a lot of things I'm not willing to fight about. I'm willing to fight about this. Ecclesiastes is not about the meaninglessness of life under the sun. Under the sun meaning life without God. Okay? Now, the reason I say that's not what it is about is because that's what a lot of people say it's about. All right? Ecclesiastes is not about the vanity of life. Okay? Ecclesiastes is not an evangelistic tract appealing to postmoderns, existentialists, or nihilists. By the way, there are plenty of people that think that that's exactly what the book is about. Ecclesiastes is what would technically be called protest literature. And what we mean by that is that it is presenting a view of wisdom that is not conventional wisdom. So in the Bible, there are places that actually deal with what we could call unconventional wisdom. In other words, deals with wisdom from a vantage point that's different than the Proverbs. Okay? The Proverbs would be conventional wisdom. That is, the Proverbs depict life as it should go. It presents life somewhat in black and white formulaic terms. You do this, God does that. Okay. You're diligent, you'll be rich, right? We've seen passages like that. Unconventional wisdom would be the book of Job. Okay. Who actually operates according to conventional wisdom in the book of Job? His friends. Job is an exception to the rule. The rule is you do bad things, bad stuff happens, right? That wasn't Job's case. Job is a case of unconventional wisdom. Psalm 73 is the wisdom psalm, and it's a psalm that is devoted to unconventional wisdom. In fact, it is one of the most honest grapplings in the Psalms with a fundamental problem that the people of God have when they embrace a certain worldview. If you're wicked, There should be consequences in God's world. What does the psalmist in Psalm 73 see? He sees the wicked enjoying life. Then, if you're righteous, you should be blessed. And he sees righteous people not doing nearly as well, being well off as wicked people. This is a dilemma. And so Psalm 73 is devoted to what we might call the exceptions. And the book of Ecclesiastes is wisdom from God, contrary to the Scofield Reference Bible that says it's just purely human wisdom. So if it's just purely human wisdom, in what way is it inspired? If it's just purely human wisdom, in what way is it beneficial? In which way is it profitable for doctrine, correction, reproof, and instruction in righteousness? Okay. So the book of Ecclesiastes is wisdom from God, but it is wisdom that deals with, in a sense, the pain of life, the exceptions to the rules. And of course, the exceptions are not rare exceptions, right? You have the miserable poor and the miserable rich and the happy poor. That's an exception to the rule, but it's a common exception. So Ecclesiastes is a book that helps us navigate through life. But here's the thing. If you've opened up to Ecclesiastes, you can see New American Standard, the words of the preacher. Of course, that's not the best. ESV says what? Teacher? Preacher? Okay. Still not the best. The reason the word preacher isn't the best and the word teacher isn't the best is because the word has a connotation to it that neither preacher nor teacher captures. So if you remember when I taught through the book, I preferred just simply the title of the book, which is Qohelet. That's the author, Qohelet. Now, Qohelet is Solomon, all right? So the words of Qohelet, the son of David, king in Jerusalem, and then the New American Standard says, vanity of vanities, says Qohelet, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Now, maybe I'll do this Wednesday night, I'm not sure. There's a reason why our English Bibles take the word, the Hebrew word chavel, and translate it vanity, okay? And it's a wrong reason, and it's a bad translational tradition, all right? But people read verse 2, okay? Vanity of vanities, all is vanity, says the preacher, right? And they look at that as the theme of the book. And so the NIV says meaninglessness. And so here's what I want to submit to you is that the key to understanding Ecclesiastes is in understanding the repeated terms in the book, okay? And so the first repeated word that we see is the word chavel, okay? NAS translates it vanity. Chavel shows up 37, maybe 38 times in the book of Ecclesiastes. And let me just give you poor translation choices. Vanity, New American Standard, ESV. By the way, vanity actually comes from Jerome's Vulgate, vanitas, and actually doesn't make sense or even capture what Jerome was even getting at. Empty. Futility, New English Translation, Christian Standard Bible, and then meaningless, NIV, which, by the way, think about this. If what Solomon is actually saying at the very beginning is meaninglessness of meaninglessness, all is meaningless, you could stop reading. Right? If everything is meaningless, right? And there are philosophical worldviews that think that everything is meaningless. If everything is meaningless, then why take the effort to talk about that which is meaningless, all right? By the way, the Bible never teaches us that the life that God has created and given is meaningless. Okay? Even for an unbeliever, their life is not meaningless. Okay? So what do we do with this word? Well, this word is better translated vapor, mist, or breath. Okay? So, by the way, James 4:14, our life is a vapor, actually captures better the meaning of havel than most of the ways that our English translators do it. Now, by breath, it means the breath or the breath that you would see on a cold morning. Okay, mist. What's the point of vapor, breath, mist? Well, the point is that it is brief. It's transient. At times, the word havel can have this notion of fog or mist, and by way of implication could be something that is elusive or puzzling or mysterious, but you have to keep in mind that it is mist, fog, breath. So think about this. If we mistranslate havel at the very beginning and say everything is vanity or everything is futile or everything is meaningless, guess what that does? That colors the way that you interpret the whole book. Okay? I don't actually know of another example in biblical studies where the translation of one word colors the interpretation of an entire book more than havel in Ecclesiastes. So Graham Ogden, who is a fine Ecclesiastes scholar, he says to persist with the traditional gloss vanity with its ambiguity of excessive pride or worthlessness lends such a negative cast to the term and thus to the book that it should be avoided at all costs. Okay. Another term that's used regularly, often coupled with havel, is chasing after the wind. Okay. Trying to grasp the wind. Actually, trying to shepherd the wind. The idea can be, as the wind is unpredictable, so is life. It could be trying to shepherd the wind represents an impossible task. Vexation, affliction of spirit, we'll talk about that in a few minutes. The troubling aspects of life, so you have havel, short life, breath, vapor, often associated with chasing after the wind or even affliction, pain, grief. So what is he doing? He's painting a picture of life for us that's painfully short. He's painting a picture of life for us that is sometimes mysterious, but always transient. Okay. And that brings with it its own pain. Next term is under the sun. Some people have said that this is the key to understanding sort of the antithesis, under the sun, and then, you know. So, for instance, Jay Adams has a commentary on Ecclesiastes that, in my opinion, is not very good. I like Jay Adams, but this isn't very good. And it's life in the sun. And so his whole thing is, hey, get above the sun, right? That is to quit living down here and live up there. And so it creates this antithesis, life under the sun. Under the sun, in Ecclesiastes, is not life without God. In fact, under the sun as life without God is seriously mistaken. By the way, under heaven is also a synonym that's used a number of times. Life under the sun is just ground level life. It's where you live. Under the sun is life that is a vapor. But it's ordinary life. Okay? It may be death row cell life, but it's just life. And so everybody that lives in this world lives life under the sun. It's just the way life is. It's a vapor. Who's it a vapor for? Everybody. You don't get extra time because you're a Christian. Life is just short, period. And it's just life. Under the sun, life is just life. And so it's not life without God. It's just life, short life, hard life. But life is a gift. Next important term, labor or toil. The word toil or labor is not the typical word for just work. It has the nuance of, as theological word book of Old Testament says, the drudgery of toil, rather than focusing on the nobility of labor. So work is a creation ordinance, right? God created work. But because of the fall, labor now has a monotony to it. Toil has a drudgery to it. How many of you ever experienced that? Okay, so the rest of you need to get a job. Sometimes labor feels like you dig a hole on one day and fill it up the next. And that's what life, and that's what work seems like. You do the same thing. So when we taught on this years ago, I said this is captured by doing laundry, right? Doing laundry, or somebody said doing dishes, right? So does anybody ever get tired of doing laundry? If you have kids, don't you ever say, "I thought I just washed this," right? But it's just sort of this monotony. There's a drudgery to it. So start to put the picture together. Life is a vapor. It's ordinary life. We're here today, gone tomorrow. And the prime of it is spent in toilless labor that seems so monotonous. Okay. This is Ecclesiastes. The next word is profit. And by the way, profit has nothing to do with, it's not a commercial term. It's related to the idea of both labor and wisdom. The idea of profit is what remains after working so hard. Sometimes we translate it advantage. So what's the advantage of working so hard? Or what's the advantage of wisdom? This is what Ecclesiastes wrestles with. What is the advantage? What's the advantage of being wise? What do you have left over after you spend your life of wisdom? Because you die just like the fool. Okay? So does wisdom really have an advantage? So this is what Ecclesiastes wrestles with. So in the book, profit is not what is the meaning of life, but the idea is, what is the advantage of toiling? What is the advantage of doing the right things? Now, I want to suggest that the very idea of advantage is far more central to the overall interpretation of Ecclesiastes than we give it credit for. So look at 1:2 again. So we're going to do this a little awkwardly, but Havel of Havels, says Kohelet, Havel of Havels, all is Havel. What advantage does man have in all his work, which he does under the sun? I would suggest to you that 1:3 actually is far more significant in framing the discussions in Ecclesiastes than we give it credit for. So here the idea is that we have this transient life. It's a vapor. It's a vapor of vapors. And so what is the advantage? What is the profit? What is the reward, if you will, of spending the best part of your life in toil? One commentator says, transience of life itself and the transience of our labors and joys. These are significant themes of this speech, but these realities of a fallen world are not licensed for negativity. Coping with and thriving within this transient life is the compensatory theme in Ecclesiastes. So what Solomon is doing in Ecclesiastes is he's helping us grapple with this life as we experience it, with all of its pain, with all of its mystery, with all of the enigma, with all of the toil, with all of the questions. And so other terms that are used regularly: pain, grief, and evil. Okay. If you have a lot of wisdom, Solomon says you're going to have a lot of pain. Why? Because you're going to understand things and have insight into things as they really are, and life under the sun is painful life. But he's also going to use words like good and better and gift and reward and joy or enjoy or rejoice. And so this is where we start to kind of bring things together. So Kohelet is going to teach us that this vaporous, short life that is often filled with affliction and evil and pain and is spent toiling away our best years is the gift of God. In fact, we're going to see in a few of the thematic paragraphs, what Solomon wants us to understand is that this vaporous short life, If you don't see it as the gift of God, you'll never enjoy it. It will be nothing but frustration to you. But the minute that you begin to see it as the gift of God, that your labor is a gift from God, and the ability to put food on your table and to enjoy a meal and to enjoy life with the woman whom God has given you, even in this fleeting life, that it is the gift of God. When you see that it's the gift of God, that is what empowers you to enjoy it. To me, there's no better illustration of capturing this theme in Ecclesiastes than thinking about raising our children. All right? So, what does absolutely everybody say when they see somebody with little kids? Enjoy it. It goes by so fast, right? Right? And sometimes it's easy to get depressed because So if life is a vapor, guess what the chapters of life are? They're vapors within vapors. And we can become incredibly depressed, incredibly frustrated, incredibly grieved because a chapter of life is closing and we so badly want to hang on to it. And the fact is that God has not designed it that way. So the only way to enjoy the successive chapters of life is to enjoy it as the chapter that God has given you. And then when the page turns, be ready to embrace the next gift. Being grateful for the years that have seemed to go by so quickly. So I go back to notes on Ecclesiastes that I have taken over the years, and I see this. I can't believe that next year Ashley is going to start high school. Where have the years gone? They've gone by so quickly. Well, she finished high school and college and is now raising children. You talk about the dizzying speed of life. And there's a way to ruin it. There is a way to ruin it. And so if your greatest desire is for your child to stay 3 years old, you're not looking at life as a gift. You're looking at it as something that you possess and you hang on to with all of your might. And the thing is that if life is a vapor and you can't catch the wind, then you hold everything with a loose grip. If your goal is to have your children live with you for the rest of their lives. Okay. Yeah, some of you are like, are you kidding me? Okay. No, that's not my goal. Well, good. There are some parents like, oh, I don't want them to get married till they're 50. Oh, that's really nice for them. Here they are, you know, an old maid at 50 and unmarried. And they go, someone says, why aren't you married? My mom and dad have been praying that I wouldn't get married until I turned 50. You can spoil the gift by trying to cling on to the chapters that are already written, and it's like trying to catch the wind. And so you enjoy it while you have it because it's short. Come to grips with that. It's short. And if you can come to grips with the vaporous aspect of life, you're in a far better place to enjoy it as a gift. All right, so what I'm going to just encourage you to do something. Take, not right now, but take colored highlighters or pencils or pens and go through and read the book of Ecclesiastes and circle in different colors all the repeated words. Pay attention to labor. Pay attention to toil. Pay attention to work. Pay attention to however your translation does, havel, vanity, and start to circle all of those. And what you start to see is that there is an overarching theme that looking at Ecclesiastes is a negative book about meaninglessness of life misses the point altogether. All right, so let's talk briefly here about Qohelet's warnings on money. All right, so you might already start to get a feel for how money is going to play into this broader life view, right? So you begin with the theme that we've already seen. Vanity of vanity, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What advantage does man have in all his work which he does under the sun? Now, by the way, what's going to happen in verses 3 then through 11 is there's going to be this monotony. The sun rises, the sun sets, and life today is like it was yesterday, and there is a monotony to it. So when he asks the question, what is the advantage of toil? What is the advantage of labor in life under the sun? Understand that labor and toil is associated with the way that you make your living. It's the way that your income comes to you, right? So let me just, what is the purpose of ticketing guys that have the wrong bait? Money for the state. Okay. Yeah. Oh, this has turned out better than I could ever imagine. And then what does the state do with it? Wisely uses it for the betterment of its citizens? No. So it's havel, it's a vapor. I go to work, I do the same thing every day, and as I do the same thing every day, nothing ever changes. Okay? I've become cynical when it comes to politics. You should too. I'm going to Washington so I can change things. Who's ever changed anything? Right? And then on top of that, we have people going to Washington as a congressperson who thinks they're going to sign bills and be inaugurated. Oh, dead serious. And the three branches of government are the three chambers of Congress. These are people that are elected now. So if you're not cynical about politics, you totally should be, all right? But here's the thing is everybody has a desire. I'm going to go. I'm going to bring change. And it's like, no, you're not. You're going to go. You're going to get sucked into the vortex that is Washington, D.C., and you're going to end up being just like everybody else. And then if you're not, nobody's going to listen to you anyway. And then you're going to be out of a job in 2 years or 6 years. Right? There's a monotony to life. There's a thing. Why am I doing what I do? You could do the same thing with counseling, right? You know, I don't tell jokes, but this is funny. There was a guy who was a pastor for years, and he quits. Turns in his resignation, quits. And then he goes and gets a job at the morgue. And somebody from his former church sees him at the morgue and says, what are you doing here? He goes, I love this job. Here, when people come in, you straighten them out and they stay that way. This vexation sends Solomon on a journey in chapters 1 and 2. The journey that we read in 1 and 2 is not a journey of abject hedonism. It is not a journey in better living through chemistry. It's a journey that tries to answer the question, what is the advantage of toil in this life? And so what does Solomon do? Well, he accumulates massive amount of wealth, right? He builds. He is, so here's the thing is he's building, he's trying to get achievements to be the advantage of his life. Right? You know there are people like this, right? It's all about the achievement. And so if I can get my name on something, if I can build something, and so for him it's gardens and parks and these massive structures, and he accumulates all of this wealth, and then he says in chapter 2 and verse 10, he says, all that my eyes desired, I did not refuse them, I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart was pleased because of, notice this, all my labor. And this was my reward for all my labor. So what's the reward for all of his labor? Being pleased with his labor. Verse 11. Thus I considered all my activities, all my works, which my hands had done, and the labor which I had exerted, literally the toil with which I toiled. And behold, all was vapor. Striving after the wind, trying to do the impossible, and there was no profit under the sun. Okay? So in other words, this whole effort at accumulating wealth does not give him any sense of advantage or profit in this life, because he realizes that everything that he's done is still a vapor. If you can't get rid of the Havel quality of life, then no matter what you do, it's always going to be under the pall of the brevity and transience of life. And I mean, seriously, so you think about these senators who want to make sure that their names are on buildings and stuff in their home states. And then nobody even remembers why that building is called the Robert Byrd Center for Democracy or whatever. Okay. Nobody even remembers. Nobody cares. That's the painful part, if it's your achievement, is that the vaporous nature of life results in the fact that nobody cares. Okay. So, here's Solomon, and he says, so I'm trying to figure it all out. And then we got to look at verse 18. He says, thus, verse 17, let's start at verse 17. So I hated life. There's a sermon text for you. For the work which had been done under the sun was, notice this, grievous, painful to me, because everything is vapor and striving after the wind. Solomon says, so you know what? When I look at everything that I did, everything that I built, everything that I accumulated, and then I began to realize that it's all going to be for nothing, my conclusion at this point in this journey is I hated life. Verse 18, thus I hated all the fruit of my labor for which I had labored, right? The fruit of my toil for which I had toiled under the sun, for I must leave it to a man who will come after me. This, by the way, causes tremendous pain. You work hard, you build an empire, you die, and then you leave it to a knucklehead that didn't do a thing to get it, and then he wastes it away. And who knows? Awesome. Musical. Yeah, all right. So, who knows, the guy who comes after me, who knows whether he'll be a wise man or a fool? Yet he'll have control over all the fruit of my labor, for which I labored by acting wisely under the sun. This too is a vapor. Therefore, notice his language, I completely despaired of all of the fruit of my toil for which I had toiled under the sun. When there's a man who has labored with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, then gives his legacy to one who has not labored with them, this too is vanity and a great evil. For what does a man get? Back to this theme. What does a man get in all his labor and in his striving with which he labors under the sun? Because all his days his task is painful and grievous. Even at night his mind does not rest. This too is a mist. So, first big picture view of money. Everything you work for, everything you save, everything you build, everything you invest in is a mist. It's a breath on a cold morning. And it's all going to be gone. Keep that in mind. Keep that in mind. If you're into empire building and legacy leaving, just realize your empire is a mist and your legacy will be a breath on a cold morning. That's cheerful. It's realistic. Do you think that actually helps you navigate through this vaporous life a little better? You better believe it does. So we don't have time to go through all of the things that he says, but notice over in chapter 4, so again, there's logical connections to these things. Okay. So there's the havel of the accumulation of wealth, there's the havel of labor. And then as a result, there's a call to be balanced. So notice in chapter 4, he says, verse 4, I have seen that every labor and every skill which is done is the result of rivalry between a man and his neighbor. Okay. So by the way, I'm a capitalist through and through, all right? But what's the engine of capitalism? It's competition. Rivalry with your neighbor. Be better, do better than the next guy. Okay? He says, this too is a vapor, striving after the wind. The fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. One hand full of rest is better than two fists full of labor and striving after the wind. Okay. The fool does what? Little sleep, little slumber, little folding of the hands to rest. Boom. His poverty comes upon him like an armed man, right? And so the sluggard, the lazy man, the fool, actually just folds his hands. That is, he's not active. He's not industrious. His hands are folded. He's resting. And of course, what ends up happening to him? Well, he consumes his own flesh. That is, he destroys himself. Solomon's going to say something else in a different place than what he says here, but keep this in mind. So what's the advice in verse 6? Be content. The fool's hands are folded. What should be in one hand? What? Quietness, rest. What's in the other? A shovel, yes. You've got the cotton patch version. One handful of rest is better than two hands, two fists full of labor. You see what he's saying? Don't work all the time. Don't work all the time. He's going to advocate hard work. There's no doubt about it. And he absolutely repudiates laziness, the laziness of the fool. But there's a balance. Why is that really so important? Well, if life is a vapor and it's gone before you know it, so you know what's better? Is to have rest in one hand than to have toil in both. Now, what's the implication of what's in the other hand? What's in the other hand is toil. But it provides a balanced perspective of life. And so we have a word for the person that has toil in both hands. We call them a workaholic. Life is consumed with work. Everything revolves around work. And men, as important as it is to provide for your families, which of course that is a biblical admonition, the reality is that to devote yourself to work in such a way that work is an idol robs your family of something that you are supposed to also be providing them. When my dad, I love and respect my dad with everything that's in me. When he came home from Vietnam, he worked three jobs. I think he slept probably 3 hours a night to provide for his family. Okay. That's a noble thing. But you don't do it any longer than you have to. It doesn't become a way of life. The same God who instituted work also instituted rest, instituted times of quietness and reflection. And so the first warning is really be balanced in your approach to the work that God has given to you. Was that the Psalms? Genesis? I heard something by day and I was like, wow. That's another, another great sound effect, you know? First we get some of this, you know, this classical sounding elevator music right at the right moment, and you know, the interjection of Genesis, which is totally appropriate. Now, chapter 5. Verse 10, he who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves abundance with its income. This too is vanity. This too is chavel. When good things increase, those who consume them increase. So what is the advantage to their owners except to look on? The sleep of the working man is pleasant, whether he eats little or much. But the full stomach of the rich man does not allow him to sleep. So the first warning about money in verse 10 is don't love it. If you love it, you'll never be satisfied with it. If it is your idol, it will never yield enough satisfaction to your heart, ever. You shouldn't love abundance with its income because what it will never satisfy your heart. Okay. By the way, it's not just money in Ecclesiastes. It's life as achievement. That's that which we build all of that. And how many times have we heard people who have accumulated vast amounts of money and have been incredibly successful in this life, and they turn around at the end of their life or even in the middle of their life, they end up becoming alcoholics or drug addicts, or they end up ending their life. And the bottom line is they were never happy. They had absolutely everything that this world has to offer, but they were never happy. And so Solomon says, listen, if you love money, money's never going to make you happy. Because if you love it, you'll never have enough to be happy. It's all a vapor. Come to grips with it. Then notice what he says in verse 11. Somebody explain verse 11. When good things increase, those who consume them increase. So what is the advantage to the owners except to look on? Good things. ESV do good things. Is that the way they do it? Goods increase. I don't think so. When you have a lot of money and you have a lot of stuff, the people around you that want it increase. Ron. Oh, yeah, okay, there you go. You pay more taxes, okay? Unless, of course, you're GE. My apologies to all the GE people that get their nice living from a company that barely pays taxes. Now, so here's the thing, though, is that just because you get more good, just because you get more stuff, you have to realize that there is this really simple law that as those things increase, guess what? Those who consume them increase. So here's just an amazing story about John Wesley. John Wesley, at the beginning of his life and ministry, lived on, and it was like 20 pounds a year. He gave £2 for his tithe, and so in essence lived on 18 pounds. As his life went on, though, his income increased. Of course, they didn't have inflation in the same way that we do, but as life went on and he published and he was more well-known, his income increased. But you know what his goal was? To live on 18 pounds. So that his goods increased, those who consumed them wouldn't. So he's generous, gave away stuff all the time. Right? What's the American way? Make more, spend more. Now the real American way is make more and then spend more than you make. Okay? Verse 12, we'll end this with this. The sleep of the working man is pleasant, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich man does not allow him to sleep. Here's one of those grand exceptions. The man that works hard and barely has enough can lay his head down at night with a good conscience, knowing that he's been pleasing to God by doing the work that God has given him to do. The rich man is full and he can't get any sleep. Why can't he get any sleep? He's got so many concerns. And the guy that has money is always thinking about how to make more money, so his wheels are always turning. There's a contentment that comes with just doing the work that God's given you to do it well before him, and to have a good conscience that I've done my labor today as unto the Lord, and I'm fine with that. The person that's consumed with money never sleeps. They may have Egyptian cotton and silk pajamas and not sleep nearly as well as the guy sleeping in a gunny sack on a hay mattress. Okay. So Ecclesiastes compels us in terms of the warnings, in a sense, to have a balanced approach to money. Next, or in 2 weeks, what we'll do is we'll look at Qohelet's exhortations to enjoy life and money, and that's where it's going to get real fun, because he's going to tell us money is the answer to everything. Okay, all right. So remember to bring your questions next week. If you have questions about Ecclesiastes, you can bring those next week, but I'm sure you'll have other questions that are more practical. So let's pray. Father, thank you for this wonderful little book of Ecclesiastes, and thank you for the message that it has for us. And we pray, Father, that you would remind us even today that this life you've given us is a short life, but it's a gift from you. We pray that we would glorify you by enjoying the gift. In Christ's name, amen.
We hope that you were edified by this message. For additional sermons, as well as information on giving to the ministry of Grace Community Church, please visit us online at gracenevada.com. That's gracenevada.com.